Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Evening, everyone. Come on in, settle down, grab a seat. I'm glad you are here. Let me just start with a story unrelated to this. Well, it's related, I should say. I was in Miami Beach a week ago, last Shabbos, and my grandfather was taken to the hospital. On Thursday, we went down for Shabbos, and I spent Shabbos with him in the hospital. Thank God everything is okay. Point of the story is that I was there Saturday night till Sunday morning. Sunday morning was Hanukkah, and I really wanted to daven with a minyan, hallel. So I found out the times of all the different minyanim, and I missed them. I just couldn't get out of the hospital. You know, those of you who've been in a hospital, there's like no day, there's no night. It's whenever anybody wants. It's couldn't get out. So I finally get out. It's about 10 o'clock in the morning, 10:30. So I go to the place where we were staying in, it's called a building called Tower 41. They have a shul on the lobby of Tower 41. And the room is empty. It's 10:30 in the morning. There's nobody there. It's a room exactly like this, facing this way. Tables on both sides with rows. Seats are on both sides of the table. 20-25 tables in the room. Find a table and I start to daven shacharis. And about 15 minutes later, for those of you who know Tower 41, there are a lot of Bubbies and Zadies in Tower 41. Old Hungarian Holocaust survivors are there. And Ayid straggles into the building, into the room, about 15 minutes into my late shacharis, and pulls off two chumashim off the shelf, and he comes and he sits down at my table. It's an empty room, 25 open tables. I'm davening at one of these tables, and he comes and he sits down at that table. He puts one chumash on the other side of the table, one chumash in front of his table, and I'm standing right next to him. Sure enough, another yid walks in, and they sit down across from each other, and they start to get ready to learn. It's like, maybe they don't see that I'm here. But you know what? You guys stay where you are. I'll move. So I go to a back table, and sure enough, another two Zaydis come in, and they pull over seats, and they pull out a phone, and they call somebody up, and on speakerphone they have a shiur in Yiddish on Chumash in the room. And I'm watching the scene develop from the back, and I went to check. It wasn't a smartphone. It was just an old-fashioned cell phone. And I couldn't believe that they sat down at my seat. I couldn't believe it. This room full of empty tables. Clearly that was their seat. Clearly that was the table they learned at week in and week out. But you know, there's like, make a slight adjustment. And it occurred to me that really, that was beyond them. At their age, at the stage where they were up to, come on and just pull over a chair. At the stage where they were up to, it was a big deal. It was a huge deal because everybody's coming in slowly with their walkers, and it's like if one guy switched, then everybody else to figure out where to go. It was like too much to do. So they said, "This is where we sit." That there's some young guy here davening. Like, I don't care. We're going to do our thing, and if he's in our way, we're just going to steamroll him over. We're going to do our thing, and it doesn't make a difference. And it occurred to me that in life, it's so often that it doesn't quite go the way that we want. That we had a certain plan. We had a certain agenda as we were going to do things, and it didn't work out the way. Someone was in our way. And it takes a lot of energy to adjust and to do things differently than you were planning on doing it. To switch tables. And at a certain age, we don't have that energy anymore. We do what we do, we're set in our ways, and nobody's going to budge us from the way that we do it. And it's when we're young that we have the ability to make that adjustment. And it is an adjustment. It takes energy. And in marriage particularly, I just wanted to start with this little story. So many times we get stuck in, this is the way it's supposed to be. And when something veers off of that, I don't care that you're at my table. I'm just going to do what I want to do, and I'll steamroll anybody in my way. And it takes a lot of energy to be able to do that. And I'll just start with that as to what we are, what we're hoping to do. This particular workshop, I'm glad to do. I've been working on this for about 5 years. It seems to me that nobody here has been in any of the ones that I've done. I've done different stages. Some of you were in some of the older ones. Were you guys there? Some say face and trying to remember. I've done and added over the years. I've had a chance to do this workshop now in a shul in Woodmere in New York and in Miami Beach while I was there. And each time I do it, I add a little component and different elements to it. So some of you, over my years here in different aspects, I've mentioned different things in different parts, but I'm just going to go through this as if none of you have been at any of it before, and I hope it will work out. The idea of this for me came about from a combination of a couple of things. Number one, from a comment that I read in a book by John Gottman, who's a psychologist out in Seattle. He's a Frum guy, actually. And he asks the following question. Of the following three items, which would be the most important in marriage? Communication skills, conflict resolution skills, or friendship? Those are your three options. Communication skills, conflict resolution skills, friendship between husband and wife. Votes for communication skills. Conflict resolution. And friendship. So I guessed one of the first two. I would have thought it would have been either communication, conflict resolution. He writes very strongly that it's all about friendship. Surprised me, friendship. Friendship? Like, people get married because they're friends, right? I mean, you're dating, things are going well, you want to be with each other. But in the over the course of a marriage, the level of friendship that exists is the context of our entire lives. If you think about it, it's very rational. It makes a lot of sense. The way we interpret events, comments, mistakes, the level of friendship completely changes how we interpret things. How are we willing to do things for other people? When someone who we like no relationship with us asks us to do them a favor, we normally say, like, I don't know, like, who are you? Like, you're asking me to do something. Someone, a good friend, they're not a big deal. Within a marriage, we're always doing that, and the context, how fast we are to forgive, how fast we are to do favors, how we interpret, the atmosphere of the home is dictated by the level of friendship. A very interesting point when he writes that. And he writes that it's actually something we work on, because when we're dating, and in the first years of marriage, we spend a lot of time talking, and then life gets really busy, and we spend less time talking, we spend more time coordinating than we are actually connecting, and it's something that can be addressed and worked on. That point, I then connected to the fact that I had been to many, many, many Shalom Bayis Shmuzin over the years, in yeshiva, and after yeshiva, and they're beautiful talks, and everybody's, they're good. They really are good. Except by the time I would get home, it was, as like, I didn't remember what was said. Maybe Rifki had been there, she wasn't there, she would go, I wouldn't go. It occurred to me that if you could take that concept and do it while you have couples actually there in the room, like, I have you now, you all have either babysitter, you're here, you're stuck, you're with your spouse. We're going to do it right here, right now. So I started developing different... Every time I would come across something, I'd try to work it, develop it into something that can be addressed and worked on while you were here on the spot, that you'll actually spend the time now doing it. So this is the longest I'm going to talk consecutively for the rest of the evening. The rest of the time, you'll see I have a whole bunch of activities that we'll do in which you actually get to work on it amongst yourself. Just as an example of one of the things that I like to do, I like to start off, this is one of my favorites. I've probably done this by many of you may have heard this. Would all the introverts in the room stand up, please? No, you don't have to do that. Usually nobody wants to do that. You're like an introvert. I don't want to be an introvert. That's fine. I would consider myself an introvert, and I want to redefine a little bit the concept of an introvert. For those of you who are saying, no, that's ridiculous. You're not an introvert. Look at you. You're up there in front of all these people. If you look them up, if you look it up online, introvert, extrovert, a lot of different definitions given to that. But I just thought I would focus on one. And define it as follows. When you're in a social setting, are you exerting effort? Are you spending effort to be in that setting? Or are you drawing energy from that environment? An extrovert in a social setting draws energy from that experience. I'm with people, and it's enlivening. I walk into a room full... I'm not saying that. I'm not this way. But an extrovert would walk into a room full of people, and it's like, whoa... Got all these people to talk to, and another one, and another one, and it's effortless. Not only is it effortless to communicate, but it's invigorating to be involved in it. Just pull over some chairs, find an empty spot. It's invigorating to do so. The introvert is in the same setting, might be equally adept in a social setting. Very comfortable. You'd think, you'd look at them, and they know what they're doing, they're fine. Except as they're doing it, they're exerting energy. I have to put effort into being involved. So that at the end of a Shabbos Kiddush, the extrovert is bouncing off the wall because look at all these people. And there's still more people here. And the introvert is, can we go home, please? And they're really exhausted because It is. And the extroverts looking at them, they're saying, but you're so good at this. Look at all the people you're talking. I know. Do you know how many people I spoke to? I spoke to 15. They count in their head how many people they're speaking to, because each one is putting forth energy. Shabbos lunch, if you've been at someone's house Shabbos lunch and somebody at like 3 o'clock, 3:30, they just like shut down. They're like finished. That's the introvert. They've like been giving and giving and giving. And then there comes a certain point and they're like, I'm just done. I don't have any energy left. I'm finished. An extrovert never wants to end the Shabbos lunch because like they're with people, and then when they're with people, they're drawing energy from the social setting. At the end of a Shabbos, for example, both people are exhausted in the couple. The husband, the wife, they're exhausted. Well, how do you recharge? Well, if you're an extrovert, how do you want to recharge? You got to go out. Let's get together with somebody. Let's hit the town. Because I'm exhausted. What do I do when I'm exhausted? Need to be with people because I draw energy from that. What is the introvert thinking? Go out? You want to go out? Like that's. I'm exhausted. I'm so tired. I can't imagine anything worse than going, I just want to be by myself. And relax. Now the reason why I like starting this is because I usually have couples like looking at each other and nudging each other, because I have found anecdotally over 80% of the couples that I have done this with are intermarried in this respect. And it's totally gender neutral, whether or not it's the husband who's the extrovert or the introvert. It's totally gender neutral, but they are complete opposites. Now this is very significant for a couple to have the vocabulary to communicate with. This is where we'll start off, and I'll just give you an example from my own life. I'm an introvert, which means that I feel very comfortable in a social setting, but I have to exert energy. So by the end of a kiddush, at the end of Shabbos lunch, after speech, I am exhausted. I'm tired. I put forth energy. I like my job. I love what I'm doing, but it makes me tired because that's who I am. I can't control that. There's nothing that I could do to change. That's who I am. Rivki, as any of you who know her knows, is an extrovert. She thrives with people. So, comes one Saturday night, and she had made plans that she wanted to get together with some friends, and she wanted me to be there. Now, whenever she made those plans, it sounded fine to me, whatever. But by the end of Shabbos, I have nothing left. Nothing left. We have to go out. Now, an introvert, when they get into a social setting, the first question an introvert asks is, an introvert, when are we leaving? Right, introvert, like, when are we leaving? Why does the introvert need to ask that question? Because I need to exert energy to be in the setting, and I need to like pace myself. I need to know like when is the end. And the extrovert never asks that question. They're not bothered by that because when, like it'll end when everybody sleeps. I'm the only one standing here. I'll go home. But as long as somebody's here, like what's the problem? But an introvert doesn't function that way. I need to know like how long is this? But I didn't have this vocabulary. I hadn't discovered this little part of my workshop yet. So we like trudge out, and I'm finished. And she's exhausted, but she's going to like recharge when we get to wherever we are. But I am finished. So I'm in misery because there's no end in sight. Like we get somewhere and it's like one of those eternal, like there's no agenda. You just sort of like, it doesn't work for me because I can't handle that. So I'm a misery because I don't, it's like if you would have told me like 2 hours, then I could, okay, I can manage 2 hours, but I didn't have that. It was just eternal. So I sit there like I'm like totally to myself because I'm trying to recharge, but it just doesn't work. So we get in the car and it's like, what in the world was that? Like, where were you? So that would be an example where had we had a vocabulary to say, like, we're going out, I could say, like, I'm exhausted. Like, how long is this going to last? I can manage. We have started taking two cars when we go to, like, say, a dinner. Because instead of the dinner ending, and I'm sitting there like, I gotta leave. And she like, but there's still more people here. So instead of us both being miserable, me wanting to leave, she wanting to stay, and whichever one is going to happen, one of us is going to be extremely unhappy, we just take two cars. And at a certain point, I say, I'll see you at home. I go home, and I'm all rested. She comes back an hour later. She's thrilled. I'm thrilled. It's like a beautiful thing. Now, I never say this to people in Shana Rishona because it doesn't sound right. But it really is a wonderful thing. If you live in a community like this where events are local, and it's not like you have to like drive 45 minutes to a wedding, like if you lived in New York, and it's really not so efficient. But here, like, that's the right thing. Just, you have a vocabulary to do it. So the first little thing, this is a short one, but just take a few minutes. If you guys want to spread out in the back there just to feel like you can communicate with each other, please do. You can even go into the corners here, whatever you're comfortable with. Identify each other. Now, none of us are always one way or another. Just human beings aren't that way. But most of us, I have found, that have a clearly identifiable approach whether or not we would view ourselves with this definition as an introvert or an extrovert. And come up with what you think you are. And at least one example that comes up regularly in your life where it would be helpful for you to have this vocabulary where you could communicate with each other and say, this is what I need for me to recharge, this is what I need, and therefore you have a starting point. This is a short one, take 3-4 minutes on this one, just to work that through. Go ahead. Okay, quick show of hands. I don't need to know who's what, but I'm just curious because of my numbers game. How many of you would say that you are clearly identifiable as opposites on this spectrum within your marriages? Wow, as usual, that's a fairly strong number. Now, people who are both introverts, by the way, those are the people you never see. They're so happy to be by themselves, they feel recharged. That's great. And they're happy. The extroverts think like, wow, they must be miserable. They're really not. They like it that way. And it's fine. If that's who they are, it's totally fine. But it is a great little tool to have a vocabulary to be able to communicate when it is that you need different things. I leave you with that, and let's move on. Okay, so Tuesday morning. As many of you know, marriages are made up of... All right, whose alarm is that? Marriages are made up of the small little things that goes on in daily lives. So Tuesday morning, you both head off in the morning off to work, and you both have the exact same thought. Today, when I get home, I'm going to do something special for my spouse. I'm going to do something. Imagine this is what happened. So you spend the day thinking, okay, what am I going to do? I have this thought, why don't I do something special? What I'd like you to think about for a minute or two is what it is that you would like from yourself. I'll just throw out examples in the sense of a bouquet of flowers, take you out to dinner, bring dinner home, buy a nice card, go for a walk. You know, just nothing major, something small. Some of those things might not be small to some of you, but that's fine. You're going to come home. Those are just what kind of things would you like your spouse to come home with to be able to say, like, I thought this morning to do something nice. This is a regular Tuesday. What it is that you would like to receive, and what would you think your spouse would like to get from you? So that what would you like to do for your spouse, and what would you like to get from them? Think about that for a second, and then we'll talk about that, not the specifics, but we'll talk about this idea. What would you give to your spouse, and what would you like to get from your spouse? Some of you, I'm sure, have heard of the 5 love languages. Oh, sorry. Those of you who have not, let me just go over them quickly. This is a great little activity. That's all right. Thank you. Anyway, most of you have heard of 5 love languages here? Yes? No? Some have? So just to quickly go over them, and you even have the book. And to put it into this particular exercise, so a fellow named Gary Chapman wrote a book called The 5 Love Languages. Rabbi Pollack in Dunwoody has rewritten it, added it for a Jewish audience. Gary Chapman's a pastor of sorts. There's a lot of scriptural references in it. But the concept of the book is a very logical, beautiful concept that I like to use. And for those of you who haven't heard it yet, let's go over it quickly, and then I'm going to use this as a springboard to the next activity. Gary Chapman holds that we speak a different language in terms of the way that we give love and the way that we receive love. In the way that we want to show somebody that we care, and in the way that we receive from them a message that someone else cares about us. And these languages are very significant in the sense of if you want to do something for someone, we naturally think in the way that we ourselves feel and express and experience things. So that if I experience something in one way, I'm naturally going to want to do that for my spouse. Except that things usually work out that your spouse doesn't exactly speak the same language that you do. So for example, just to go over these very quickly, some of us speak what he calls words of affirmation. We like to hear nice things about us. Now, by the way, we all speak all 5 of these languages. It is constant for all of us. We all like to hear all of these things. And for the men in the room, you have a very easy task because your wives like all of these things all the time. So it's really easy. You don't have to like figure out which one it is. Do them all always and you'll be a very happy person. But nonetheless, it's worthwhile knowing the differences between them. Words of affirmation is hearing nice things. Some of us function in a way, someone who speaks that language, the primary way in which they will express to someone else their feelings for them and that they want to hear love from their loved ones is when they are told how wonderful they are, how amazing, how fantastic, superb, how happy they are to be married to you. All forms of compliments, it's in words. Those of you who grew up with mushy birthday cards or anniversary cards, that's a words of affirmation type of love language, where if a birthday goes by and I don't get a mushy card filled with adjectives describing how amazing and wonderful I am, then you have not celebrated my birthday. Now, it's very important to know, if you're not a mushy kind of person, like you're not into those words, you're not into the compliments, if your spouse is, and you go out and buy a gift without a card, you miss the whole birthday. Because birthdays are about mushiness. They're about words of affirmation, about telling me how amazing I am. I don't want a fancy dinner. I want you to tell me I'm great. Now, sometimes we don't like admitting it, but it's a love language that we speak that I like to hear. And therefore, if I hear negative words, those are knives. They're daggers. Because my primary language is hearing how good I am, hearing how much you appreciate me, how much you love me in words. So when the words are negative, for me, if I speak that language, it's all the more painful. If you ever know some people, words like they roll off their backs because they don't deal with that language. It's not till they have another language. But if it is your language, then on both sides of the equation, it's going to be powerful. It's going to be powerful good and powerful for bad. Second language, quality time. Using our Tuesday example. So let's go back just to put in. So if you come home on Tuesday, and you think, well, I'm going to do something special. Well, if your spouse speaks words of affirmation, all you need to do is you need to stop off and buy a nice Hallmark card and fill it out and just say, you know, I just wanted to tell you how amazing I think you are, how much I love being married to you, what an amazing wife, what an amazing mother. Like, that would be it. Like, it didn't cost you a cent. You didn't have to go out to dinner. Like, that's what it would mean. And it would mean the world to the person who receives it. But if your spouse speaks quality time, they don't want a card. Like, if you want to show me you want to do something special for me, like, we're going out to dinner. We're going out for a walk. We're going to dedicate an hour tonight. We're going to turn off the phone, put the kids to bed. We're just going to sit on the couch. Because that's the language. Now, that's a very different experience. You're coming home Tuesday night if you have a nice mushy card, and then you go about your business, and you don't even spend another minute together for the rest of the night. If your words of affirmation, it's perfect. But if it's quality time, you got a different issue on your hand to address. Receiving gifts. Some people speak a language through gifts. And a lot of this has to do with your family of origin, how your family, you were brought up. But I'm not interested in the psychology of that for now. The question is, you know, what language do you speak? Do you like receiving gifts or not? If you're married to somebody who speaks the language of gifts and a birthday anniversary goes by without a gift, you're in big trouble. You might not speak the language of gifts and you don't care about gifts. So you didn't even think about a gift, except your spouse did and does. And therefore, they're going to receive gifts and give gifts, and it's going to be meaningful. And you're like, well, who cares about, why don't you spend your time on this? Like a waste of money. Well, if I'm a gift giver, and I give you a gift, and you say that was a waste of money, that's a very painful thing, because that's actually how I express my love, and you just sort of threw that back in my face. Acts of service, doing things for me, taking care of things around the house. People speak like, if you showed me that you love me, I would come home and the dishwasher would be put away, be clean, and I would be like, I'd be floating. That would be like the most amazing thing you ever did. Take care of the kids, put them to bed, bring home dinner. Think about the difference between a quality time and an acts of service. Quality time means, I'll take care of dinner tonight, but you take me out later. Acts of service is, you bring home dinner for me, and I'm going into the bedroom to like take a nap. Those are very different experiences. If you can think about two people who speak a different language, I'm thinking, I'm going to be so romantic, I'm coming home tonight, I'm going to bring home dinner for you while you go take a nap. And that's actually like the sign of great love, because I'm going to let you go take a nap and I'm going to take care of dinner. And that really is. Versus the person who's speaking quality time, they're like, that's, you're showing me love by sending me off to sleep? Like, we should go out together. Well, people speak different languages, and it's important to have that in mind. The last one is physical touch. I, by the way, when I had a couple came in to see me, and the time when this just completely coalesced to me in terms of its reality is the husband came in first, and actually the wife came in first and said, I don't know what to do. My husband, he's really trying. He gives me gifts. He buys me clothing. He buys me jewelry. And I don't understand why he's doing this. Doesn't he see that I have all of these kids I'm trying to take care of? I am overwhelmed with work and with dinner and with homework and with baths. He comes in the door and he goes straight up to his room and he takes a nap at 6 o'clock. And I'm drowning. And then he brings me a gift on Friday before Shabbat. Gifts? Where is he? He comes in the next day and he says, she doesn't wear any of the things I buy her. She never says thank you. She doesn't care about the things that I'm doing. I don't understand. Like, wow. Like,
read this. You have to read this.
It totally just changed, like a small little simple thing, but they were both trying, and they were totally missing each other. Physical touch is not intimacy. Physical touch is a hug, kiss, holding hands together over dinner or taking a walk. Some people just speak. They're touchy-feely kind of people, and a touchy-feely kind of person needs to feel close with the person they're close with by being close. It just is the way that it is. If you left the house without giving me a kiss in the morning, we're in a fight. Like, we must be in a fight. How could you do that? Meanwhile, if you don't speak that language, like, why would I give you a kiss before you left? Like, what are you talking about? But people speak the language. Like, how could you have gone to sleep and not given me a hug before you left? Like, how could you have done that? Like, that's ridiculous. Well, because if you speak that language, then that's how we communicate. And if you don't speak that language, it's like living in a different planet. Like, it's like, I don't know why you necessarily, like, why do we have to, like, hold hands when we're, like, eating dinner? That's, like, sort of weird to me. But it is sort of weird if you don't speak that language. But if you have a spouse who does speak that language, you might want to get used to it. So these are important concepts to be aware of, or just even to interpret your spouse's behavior towards you if they speak that language. Most of us speak two, if not three of these languages, but most of us, people anecdotally again, can identify two that's not their language. Like, that really doesn't do anything. Gifts, it's not really my thing. But if I can clearly identify what I am, and I can communicate that to my spouse, then my spouse has a major heads up in terms of how to address the regular Tuesday, how to address a birthday, this is what I like. These are the things that I like to do. So take a moment. And if you don't already know, I would tell you it's worthwhile to first guess each other and see how good you are at guessing each other's language. And then if your spouse is wrong, fill him or her in as to your top two, if not three, languages that you say you'd have. By the way, your love languages might change as you go on through life. At different stages of our life, you want different things. And for major occasions, for example, even if you're a language, let's say, of words of affirmation, and you're clear about that, that's what I need to hear. I need to hear words. But it could be that for major events, like for a 10th anniversary, 15th, 20th anniversary, maybe then, you know, you'd want quality. They're not necessarily always the same, but it's good to have a language and a vocabulary to be able to communicate. And if you can know your spouse in this, it is extremely helpful. Okay, let's do this for the next one. You see your cases in front of you, you have a scenario. As all of you should know, anyone who's been married for more than 10 minutes knows, one of the most critical things in marriage is the ability to apologize. Because none of us are perfect, and we make mistakes. And because we make mistakes, so we need to learn how to fix them. So let's go over the following case as far as how to work through an apology. Shabbos lunch, your spouse made a comment about you in front of the company that, while funny, embarrassed and hurt you. And you're sitting there right away, as soon as the spouse who said it, be it the husband, be it the wife, knows, like, whoops, like there's like a certain chill that goes over the Shabbos table, like, oh no, I'm going to have to figure this one out. Comes dessert, you pull him over aside in the kitchen to apologize. What do you want to hear? You're the one who's been offended. You've been embarrassed in front of the company. Your spouse just poked fun at you. Everybody got a good laugh, but you're feeling hurt. You're feeling embarrassed. Here are five potential statements that your spouse might say to you. What is it that you want to hear? Now, there is no right answer. I tested this out before I started doing this. And I showed it to a couple of people, and I said, so, what do you think about this? And they would say, oh, the answer is C. I say, what do you mean the answer is C? They say, it's C. Anything else doesn't count. Well, there's not. It's not like a yes or no. It's like there are different things for different people. And I asked five different people, and I got four or five different responses, and every person who responded was adamant that the only right answer is whichever one that they said. So take a look at these. What do you think you would want to hear? Not what you think your spouse will say. That I'm sure all of you can answer. The question is what you actually want to hear. Now again, here also, there might be more than one. There might be a combination of two, but probably some of these will register like, it's really not so important to hear that. Okay, let's go over these. You'll have more time to read them through as we go through. If you flip over your card, this is also from Gary Chapman. He wrote a couple of books. One he called The Five Languages of Apology. This is based on his, but I've changed it a little bit because I thought it'd be better this way. But it's based on his approach. Number one is acknowledging the hurt. Some of us, when we get an apology, if the apology is going to be real, then the one giving the apology, the one who's hurt me, has to acknowledge what they did. If you can't acknowledge the hurt that you've caused and the pain, then you haven't apologized. You can say, I'm sorry from here till tomorrow. If you haven't said what it is that you did, which would look like letter A. I embarrass you in front of the company, you're hurt, you feel betrayed, unimportant. That's what I'm going through. If you don't acknowledge what I'm going through because of you, it's not an apology. I have to hear that you know what you did. Second language would be accepting responsibility and admitting fault. I have found this to be a particularly difficult challenge for men to actually own up and accept the responsibility, so that someone might say, I realize that you're hurt or embarrassed, but no. I need you to say, it's my fault. I messed up. Not, but you started because you did this, so I did that, and because I did that, you're hurt. No. I need you to say, it's not because of anything that I did, that you acknowledge you are responsible, which would sound something like, V, I was wrong for saying that. I made a mistake, it was inappropriate, and short, poor judgment. Notice the difference between A and B. In A, I'm acknowledging what you are going through. I hurt you. I'm acknowledging that you are hurt, you're embarrassed, you're betrayed. In B, I'm saying, I made a mistake. I was wrong, it was poor judgment, and for that I'm apologizing. Those are very different kinds of statements to say in terms of what it is that you apologize. If you speak a certain language, until you hear those words, say, you didn't apologize yet. I apologize 100 times for this. No, you didn't apologize yet, because you haven't yet said what it is that I need to hear. C is making restitution, or how can I fix it? Well, alright, you made a mistake, okay. What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do to fix the problem? For me, when I experienced the validity of this particular little project, I speak a combination of A and B. Meaning that if I'm going to apologize, it's going to be working on that I'm acknowledging what I did and acknowledging that it's my fault. So when something happens in my home, as it does in your home, that's icy, chill, like cold falls over the house, it's like, oh, I know it's my fault. So I need to like acknowledge it. So it like takes me a couple of hours, especially because I'm an introvert also, to like build myself up to be able to A, acknowledge what I did wrong, and then accept responsibility for it. And that's in my head what an apology should be, just because that's how I function, so I assume everybody functions that way. So like 3 hours will go by, and you know, I'm working on myself. I'm like, it's like chilly in the air, but like, I'm working. I'm working on accepting the responsibility, on acknowledging it, and like finally 3 hours later, I'll come to, you know, say, I'm really sorry. What I did hurt you, or X, Y, or Z, and it was completely my fault, and I'm sorry for that. And the response I got for like 10 years was, you spent 3 hours on that? Of course it's your fault. Like, whose fault do you think this is? What are you going to do about it? And I'd be like, crushed. Like, I don't understand. I spent 3 hours working on that. And like, that's it? That's what I get? Like, of course it's your fault? Because Rivki speaks a different language. She wasn't interested in hearing what I did to her because she knows what I did to her. And she wasn't interested in hearing that it was my fault because she knows it's my fault. And she doesn't need to hear it from me because she knows it. She needs to hear, what are you doing about it? But I didn't even think about that as part of an apology. Like, what does that have to do with apologizing? That's like something else. So it never occurred to me. I never addressed what it was that she was looking to hear. And after all of my work and introspection and growth, it usually accomplished nothing. Until she would say, like, what are you doing? What am I going to do about it? Oh, that's easy. That wasn't a problem for me. I could fix things easily. It was a matter of accepting responsibility that was hard. But we were totally missing each other. I showed this to one of my chavrusas, and I said, like, what do you think about this? Which would you go with? So he said, oh, the answer is D. Or in his case, the answer was C. He said, the one we just did. And I showed him the thing. I said, wow, that's so interesting. Because his child, they have a timeout in their house. Had a son, who if he would do something to his younger sister, they would put him in timeout. And then in order to get out of timeout, the child would have to apologize. And I'm not a proponent. I'm not saying that I'm not a parenting thing. Just putting that aside. That's what they did. Fine. So normally, his wife was home with the kid. And he happened to have been home one time, and his son beat up on his little sister, and he put him in timeout. He comes back and he says, are you ready to apologize? And the child said, yeah, I'm really sorry for hurting whatever her name is. That's not an apology. And you're not ready to come out yet. And he come back 3 minutes later, and he said, you ready to apologize yet? And the kid would say, yeah, I'm really sorry for hurting whatever her name is, and I'm going to try not to do that again. And he said, fine. That works for mommy. I said, it makes so much sense because his wife spoke a totally different language and had trained the child that in order to apologize, what you needed to do was just acknowledge what you had done. But in his world, he didn't speak that language. He thought the apology had to include what he was going to do to fix whatever it was that had caused the problem. And in his world, like, it clicked when I had gone, like, oh, that makes a lot of sense why we're having this problem that depending on who's home with him, he learns how to apologize differently, but that's actually a helpful tool in a marriage to know how it is that one needs to apologize. But just moving on, 4D, won't happen again. Things will be different. There's a Kabbalah al-Hasid. If you're familiar with the Rambam, by the way, from Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur time, you'll notice that this is really the components of the five steps of tshuva process. We really need to do all these things, but some of us focus more than others on different ones. I'm not going to do it again. I want to commit to you that this won't happen again. I'll do my best to resist. And the last one is expressing regrets. Expressing that I really wish that wouldn't have happened. You're so valuable to me. You're important to me. I wish I wouldn't have said that. Those are very different statements, all five of them. And go back now again after having just gone through the different things with what you had originally come up with, if it's changed at all, but to be clear that your spouse knows from you what it is that you would want to hear in order to have a complete and valid apology. Okay. Quick show of hands. How many would say that you clearly identifiably speak a different language of apology than your spouse? Pretty common. Yeah, so that's tough. For those of you who speak the same language, like this is a silly activity, like I don't have a big deal with it. It's like obvious. But for those of you who speak different languages, it's very helpful to be able to be aware. If you weren't already, if you had the same aha moment that I had had, it's very valuable. But even if not, just to know what to focus on as far as that goes. Okay, if you'll take out your blue cards, there are two sets of cards here. This is just a warm-up activity for the yellow cards. I would split them into two, take two for yourself, two for yourself and give two to your spouse. The way that this works is each one holding one of the cards. Yeah, I don't know. Asks your spouse the other question. The question. Each card has five questions on it. And the question is how well your spouse can answer them to you. Now, you're asking them the question, like, name my two closest friends. Out of the 10 questions that you ask, I don't know, I don't want to put a number on it because you shouldn't feel bad if you can't answer that amount. But you should be able to at least two. Hopefully it should be a lot more than that. But if you don't know the answer, it's a wonderful opportunity for you to help your spouse out by sharing that. But hopefully they should do pretty well in this. This is sort of like, you know, how I guess a form of a newlywed kind of game sort of thing. After you've done the 10, if you have time, we'll do this for a few minutes, and then you can switch. But this is just part of the activity of now that you actually have some time. These are the kind of things that you probably once spoke about, but maybe don't do it so often anymore. But each one, do five at a time, asking the cards to each other. I hate to disturb you because your house is probably like my house and you never have this time just to sit and talk to each other. It's like so nice to see. But I'm going to disturb you anyway, just to move you on to the blue ones are a little bit more fun. A lot of it are lighter. The yellow ones are a little bit more serious. You're not going to get through all 20 because of the nature of them. But it's worth it just to follow up and to just, if you want to, you can finish the blue ones if you want, but if you want to move on to the yellow ones, put them away, put them in your glove compartment. They're nice things to take out every once in a while and to do. These are questions in which you actually ask each other, not to know about each other, but you actually ask them, like, what do you want our life to look like in 5 years? And have a chance to actually have the conversations that you probably used to have, but you might not have had in a long time just because life doesn't permit them necessarily. But I would spend a few minutes on this, and I'll do one more thing, and then I'll... Daniel, unless you want to just stay here and schmooze all night, that's also fine. I won't kick you out, but I would spend some time getting through a couple of these cards as well. Okay, let's do one last thing for tonight. Even those of you who do not speak primarily a words of affirmation love language, but we all love to be complimented. That's just the way that things go. We like to hear it, whether or not that's our primary language or not, it's a reality. The problem is, very often when we give compliments, we don't necessarily do a good job of it. We give global, defining compliments, like, you always make such a great dinner. Now, what's the problem with such a compliment like that? What's that?
It's a left-handed compliment.
Why is that
left-handed? That means that no meal is special.
All right, there's something worse than that. There's a lot of pressure in such a compliment. Right? If I say you always do this, so now I feel like I always need to do it. You know, if you come to shul and someone says you always look so dressed up, so now they might think they're saying something nice, but that may or may not be a tremendous pressure because you might now have your entire wardrobe on your bed every single Shabbos before you come to shul because you feel like you have to look all dressed up and you got to find the exact right thing. So compliments, and this is really borrowing a page from parenting. In terms of when we give compliments to our kids or to others, it needs to be simple and descriptive. Actually just describing something that took place That's a compliment that we have no resistance to, because it actually just happened. I just did X, Y, or Z. And when I hear somebody compliment me accurately, not giving a global assessment of who I am, but just saying, you did this or that, or X or Y or Z, and I appreciated that, that's a compliment that rings true and is very, very effective in creating a certain atmosphere in the home. And there's no greater atmosphere that's created in a home than where there's a lot of complimenting going on, where people notice what is happening and they can acknowledge it with specific examples of what's being done. This little activity of a long list, this is provided by John Gottman. This is from his Bringing Baby Home program, which I had done a training in San Francisco a couple years back. So it's his list. It's a long list. But what I want to do with it is we'll start tonight, because as I said, instead of sending you with homework, which I know you're not going to do, so we'll just do it right here, right now. So we'll start, and the women can go first because the men need more help with this. They're going to need the extra time to think while the women are going first. To choose something on the list. We're not going to go through the whole list. You get to choose one. Women can go first. Men can choose the same thing, but they have to say something different. And give a specific example of where your spouse has displayed. Doesn't have to be elaborate. Doesn't, just a simple one-time kind of thing. Brave. You were so brave when you took that cockroach and flushed it for me in the kitchen. And I really appreciate that. Sorry, that's just an example. But, so I would do, let's see if we can handle two, maybe even three rounds. First, let the wives will go, and then the husbands will go. You can choose anything you want from the list, and look at your spouse, and say, I noticed you are reliable, and I thank you for being reliable in circumstance X, Y, or Z, which you can give a specific example in which your spouse was, say, reliable. You can take a minute to think about it. Let's do two. I'll take it easy on you because this is sometimes hard, but this is a great exercise. And if you really want to do homework, choose one a day, come up with something, and find an example every day. When you do this with your kids, it's fantastic. Just finding adjectives to be able to describe and then pointing out exactly what it is that they did. So you can go through the list, find the things that you most admire about your spouse, and something that you can actually point to and say, and here's where you have displayed it, this is when you did it, this is when you've accomplished it, and I acknowledge and admire you for that. I need two rounds, two for the husbands, two for the wives. Okay, for those of you with babysitter issues at home, please feel free to go back. If you'd like to stay the rest of the evening, you're welcome to do so as well. This last activity is really worth working on over the course of the week. For those of you husbands who are having trouble, your wives might want to feed the words to your husbands that they need to be saying with the examples. It's fine if you have to do that to get them started. It's just, we're slow learners, but it's worth the effort. So this activity is really worthwhile, just to be able to express an adjective and acknowledge something specific to note what's going on around the house. It will completely change an atmosphere to a very healthy one and positive one in the home. So today we did love languages, we did the languages of apology, introvert, extrovert, we did some of these cards and some appreciation exercises. I have a bunch of things still to do next week. I hope you will join me again next Tuesday night, and we will finish up. I hope. Thank you for coming out tonight. Have yourself a great night.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.